welcome to our next episode of Undercooled. Today, Tim and I are going to talk about a problem that has been vexing us for, as long as we've been in material science. And actually, I believe it's a problem that has vexed material science ever since it was created. And that is, how do we convince students to major in material science and engineering? And what are we going to do about it?
Yep.
So, you know, I'll start, the biggest problem is most students don't even know what material science and engineering is. And, you know, it goes right back to high school when the teachers don't all know what material science and engineering is. They get to our engineering school, and at Michigan, we're lucky that they don't allow students to apply to a program. You have to apply to the engineering school, and then you must wait until you've taken at least one term of courses before you declare your major. And the reason is we have a lot of smaller departments like naval architecture, like nuclear engineering, that students may not know about. And so we want them to have a chance to look around and make a wise decision. But of course, we come from a distinct disadvantage because the students don't come in having any idea what we're all about, what we do, and they get such bad information from other students. So that's what we're going to talk about. And I think there's another key. Even when we do talk to them and convince them, we still have another problem that I think Tim will talk about.
And that problem, I believe you're alluding to parents, Steve. Because even kids these days, as much as we complain about them, many do get advice from their parents. And if the students go home, you know, for Thanksgiving and say, oh, I just learned about material science and engineering and I want to major in that. And mom and dad say, what? No, go be a mechanical engineer and actually get a job. That's a disadvantage that we have to figure out our way around, is growing more of this awareness, not just among the students, but among their families as well, that it's a good thing to be a materials major.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as the program advisor, I get lots of students who come in and they've been told by their peers, other students in their class, oh, you know, material science is really focused and it's a really tiny department, so that means you won't get jobs. And I say, no, it's actually the other way around. There's so few of us and so many people need material scientists that our students are in very high demand and do just as well as any student in mechanical engineering or chemical engineering or any other discipline, even more. Well, with the exception of one field recently that's actually been eating our lunch, and that field is...
the field that must not be named.
Computer science. And it's tragic. Yes, some of the salaries for students coming out of computer science are the highest salaries amongst any engineer. But when half of our undergraduate class becomes computer scientists, which is about the case, it's 40 to 50% of all the engineers at Michigan's engineering school have declared computer science. And now with all the AI stuff, it's insane. But the vast majority of those students are never going to get to do real computer science. They're going to end up getting coding jobs. They'll all get jobs. But is that what you want to do for your career, sit in a cubicle and code? You know, I don't think most people who are drawn to engineering, you know, that's a priority. Most people who come to engineering want to actually build things or be part of building things. And that's, you know, may not happen if you do computer science. It's a wonderful field, but the truth is all fields do computer science. Almost a third of our faculty in material science are computer scientists who do computational material science and do amazing computer science along the way. And I just feel students would be much better off learning an engineering discipline, but then focusing on computation if they want, because then those computational skills can take them anywhere that a CS degree would probably do. But
yeah, and most of my friends in industry, you know, when I talk to them about just work and sort of the teams that they work with at their jobs, there's always the simulation team, right? There's the data team, there's the programming team. There's no shortage of ways to deploy this skill set of coding and of computational work in an applied engineering context. And I would agree with you, Steve, that if you have that sort of fundamental engineering discipline first of mechanical or materials or, you know, biomedical or whatever, and then you add to that later the computational knowledge, that it becomes very powerful. But if all you know is how to code extremely well, then that doesn't help inform you about what problems you're coding for and what you're trying to solve with the computer.
It can even lead to problems. I mean, this is not a new problem. This goes way back. When I first got a master's degree in mechanical and aerospace sciences, I went to work for General Electric. And I went to their reentry and environmental systems division, where, you know, I was in the aerothermodynamics group that worked on calculating the flow field distribution along a reentry vehicle, and then working in tandem with, you know, people doing thermodynamics codes to figure out how the nose tip would get cusps in it and a new shock would attach. So, you know, believe it or not, we did hypersonics for a long time. Now it's a hot field again. But if your reentry vehicle is coming in at hypersonic speeds, a cusp can get cut out, ablated from the nose tip, and a sharp edge will cause a new shock wave to attack, and the vehicle goes bam. And we tracked all of that with computation. Now, our group worked with a computer science group. We couldn't do this without computer scientists, real computer scientists, because we didn't have computers big enough to even put our whole code into. We were using state-of-the-art computer with 512K core computers called a Honeywell 2000. And that's why, you know, in Fortran, we used Fortran 77 back then. You had to use the overlay command to swap out one part of the program with the next, and the comment statement told you which variables stayed there for the new part of the code to start crunching on. So there were a lot of things that we never would have been able to do unless the computer scientist took our code and translated it into something very, very efficient. And there is a tension between us and those computer guys because they didn't care about the physics in the code. They only cared about how it ran. And so we wanted to put things in that were transparent to us because we were using finite difference, we were using finite difference methods to integrate and evaluate the Navier-Stokes equations for gas flow. It was complicated. You know, we had to use conformal mapping because to get the node structure right around the shocks, we had to do it in a conformal space and then map back. And so we wanted to write the equations as clearly as possible so that when we went in to change things, we knew what we were doing. And we'd hand the code to the computer scientist and they would make it completely unrecognizable. And we're like going, no, you can't do that. I don't care about efficiency. We have to, you know, this is, we're trying to understand how this all works. It has to remain, you know, visible. So that tension, I'm sure that still exists between efficiency and, you know, understandability. But all that, we thought we were pretty cool because, you know, we were the rocket scientists, you know, flight dynamics and aerothermodynamics. There were 24 of us engineers working on that. And I used to ask my boss, what's on the floor above us? You know, it seems like they have a large group. They go, yeah, there's 80 people in that group. I'm going like, 80? Who are they? And he said, oh, that's the materials group. I'm like, what do they do? Because I didn't know. And he told me, you know, they work out all the metallurgy for the titanium, you know, structure. They made the carbon-carbon woven nose tips that, you know, what we now know as carbon fiber composites. They invented that. They invented the carbon phenolic tape that NASA used on the Mercury and the Gemini you know, things. They worked on antenna windows, all sorts of crazy materials problems, but 80 of them. And that was one reason why I quit my job and went into material science, because I realized how important. And if you really look at a lot of these big companies, ultimately, they're materials companies. And a lot of people who work for them don't even realize that, like their recruiters who forget to put materials on the list of people they're looking for, even though they really are materials companies. How do we get this word out? And then we have other problems.
Yeah, there's so many accidental discoveries, like the story that you just told of people find out sometimes years into their careers, oh, I guess actually materials problems are something that are important to me, that I like working on, et cetera. And if only we had some way to reach the students earlier, maybe something very soon in their college experience where they could find out from people who do this work, right, that the materials aspect of these engineering problems is often the critical aspect that is the discovery, right, or the invention that has to happen for progress to continue.
How do you perform the performance of any device? Usually what limits performance are the materials that are being used. And so if you want to improve the performance, you go right back to our tetrahedra. That's why performance is there, because you have to find a new material that can exceed the working conditions of the existing materials to increase the performance. So structure, properties, processing all lead to performance. So, somehow the word doesn't get out. And even when, you know, I mean, I'm sure you remember when you were looking at colleges, you probably, as a high school student, went on a college tour. And you had those students who somehow really enjoy walking backwards and not killing themselves. But you've seen college tours come through with those students. And what do you notice?
I've seen so many of these tours come through. And I noticed that they are not good at telling the story of what material science is about. That they don't think about the tetrahedron, right? That's the perfect example.
They don't know
example.
About the tetrahedron.
Or, well, that's also true. There's so many aspects of trying to answer this question. What makes material science and engineering different from other engineering disciplines? Another one that I find very compelling is that we are the ones who work at every length scale. Right, we go from electrons up to buildings. That's how many orders of magnitude is that? 15 orders of magnitude that we span. And no other engineering discipline does that, really. But you don't hear that in the tour groups. You hear, oh, yeah, you know, if you're trying to tell the difference between materials engineering and chemical engineering, it's like the chemical engineer makes the shampoo and the materials engineer makes the bottle that the shampoo is in. And it's extra frustrating because it's not quite wrong. It's actually a little bit true, but that doesn't capture what's great about either of those fields. It's like, I don't want to make shampoo bottles for the rest of my life. Of course, I'm not going to be a material scientist.
Yeah, but the chemical engineers don't invent the shampoo. They don't come up with the formulation. That's usually a collaboration of chemists with material scientists, getting the viscosity just right and all of that. The chemical engineer just takes that formulation and they scale it so they can actually make it at scale so they can sell it at a price where everyone's happy and the company makes money. And they don't mention that to the students. But the same is true for the packaging. A lot of the packaging is actually made in factories that chemical engineers build, because that's what chemical engineers do. They build factories. They build chemical plants. They build distillation columns, lots of piping, reactors. And they understand how all those things fit together so you can actually manufacture a product. And we don't do that in material science. We work on creating the actual material that will have the properties that you need to give the performance to the product so the consumer is happy.
Yeah. Well, you know, we just spent 10 minutes complaining about the problem. Students don't know who we are. Parents don't believe in us. You know, there's tension, competition for students with other majors. And then finally, the tour leaders who the students could hear about us from throw us under the bus. So this is the problem space. Being engineers, we, of course, have to say, I have defined the problem. Now, what is the solution? And, you know, just starting with the tour groups, one thing that we've tried in our department that has helped a little bit is there's a space, there's this hallway where all the tour groups come through, right? Here's the tour group coming through the hallway. And there's a pause point where the tour leaders stop and give their little speech about shampoo bottles. So we plastered the walls with posters, right? With photographs, with stories, visual stories of here is what you can do to get a job with material science. Do you want to work in healthcare? Do you want to work in finance? Do you want to work in aerospace? Do you want to work in sustainable energy? And we've got these posters that tell these stories. And what I notice as tour groups are coming through is that the students aren't really looking at those. They're listening to the tour guides or just staring off into the ether. But the parents are reading the posters about the jobs. And so this comes back to your point, Steve, about like, we need to find better ways to get the parents to understand that this is a viable career path.
I did see the tour guide read one of our posters to the students this past week. They actually said, one of the things said, materials are everything. And that's what the tour guide said. See, materials are everything. Everything's made of a material. So that's a much better message than what I've heard so far. But beyond that, I think we've been making many attempts over the years. Some work better than others. None have really solved our problem. But why don't we start to outline them? Because, you know, I think one of the reasons we're doing this podcast is to share as many of our practices and talk about it with our materials colleagues around the country so that we can all take notes and learn from each other. So I'm hoping we can run through a lot of things that worked at some level, that we talk about it, and then hopefully at the end, I'm going to be making an appeal for all those listening to us to please let us know what they're doing, because I believe this is good for our entire community, finding ways to elevate what material science and engineering is so that we can get a much larger student body than we currently have. I think, what, 3% of all engineers are material science and engineers? That's about it.
Sounds about right.
And yet, just look at the research at the College of Engineering. I think something like 40% of all of the research expenditures are materials research. And the same is true in industry. It's a very lopsided distribution. So let's start with some of our attempts. So We try every term to have ice cream socials where we offer free ice cream for students to come over to one of our tables where we have our undergrads, our Michigan Material Society students, our undergrads who really like coming to these events and teaching others about how cool material science is. They do lots of demonstrations and we talk to students and we try to choose a time and sometimes we'll get like 20, 30 names of people who want to be contacted about this. And then other times, like this term, we got 5. And so it's it works sometimes, but not always. So it's enough because, you know, even those 5 are very valuable to us. So we'll probably keep doing it. But trying to attract undeclared students to us who happen to be walking down the hall in our, we have in our, it's our library, it's the, called the Duderstadt Center. There's a big hall that a lot of students walk by at certain times of the day, and we're able to get in front of them with that message. So what else have we tried, Tim?
Well, on the theme of bribing students with food, something that we've started more recently, really just in the last year, is having invited lunches for students who have expressed an interest in MSc as a potential major. And so this is really trying to up that, I guess, conversion rate of students who have said, oh yeah, put me on the email list. Oh sure, you know, I'll list this as one of my three majors that I'm considering, to take those people and get them from MSc curious to MSc committed. And the spirit of this approach I really do believe in, which is showing a genuine interest in the person, right? We want to talk to you, the human. We want to get to meet you, get to know you, and say, what is, like, what questions are you considering in choosing a major? And of course, we're going to make a little bit of a sales pitch of why we think materials would be a suitable option. But there is something really nice about just having someone reach out to you and say, hey, I'm emailing you individually to say, I'd like to talk to you more. I don't know how many majors we've gotten declared from that. It is a pretty new program, so I don't know that we have a lot of data yet. But I think we could do more as a small department. We could leverage that small department space and, you know, do activities like this where we're contacting a couple people at a time and really giving them dedicated attention.
I think that's got more potential. That evolved, of course. That evolved from, we used to have open houses where we'd have people come to an event and we'd talk about what we did, and we just invited everybody. And we would have food at those events too, but it wasn't targeted with the individual email like you're talking about. And I think that's probably better going forward. We also even tried having dinners. I remember one disaster, we had dinner for students down on Central Campus for all the undeclared freshmen, and like two freshmen showed up. And it cost us a lot of money to rent out that big space. And the only people who came, a lot of our students came, which is fine, but only like two or three undeclared students showed up. And we stopped doing that because we realized we have to be more focused. But we also do things with casting to try to excite students. Maybe you can talk about our journey with casting.
Yeah, doing hands-on events in general with students has always been a real crowd pleaser. And yeah, we've done a few different metal casting related activities over the years. One that has gone really well is, sometimes we did this in connection with the open houses as well, is we just had a very simple tabletop setup in our furnace room where we have open sand trays with Block M imprints in the sand. And so students can melt some, you know, recycled scrap aluminum and then cast a little Block M, and then they get to keep it. And I just had the experience last year where a student was taking a class, not with me, but with someone else I know at the university. And so I saw the student, he's like, hey, do you remember me? And of course, being honest, I'm like, no, sorry, I don't, really awkward, where would I know you from? And he says, oh, I came and cast that M in your lab and I still have it, it's on my desk. I love that thing. Did he turn into a material science major? No, but there was still a connection there, and like a, you know, there was a really strong memory that was formed that day, and he obviously valued the, you know, the time and attention that we gave him enough to reach out to a random person that he remembered. So that's one activity that we've done that went really well. Another one we did several years back, one year for Halloween, we actually got clearance from EHS to do an outdoor casting activity where we were casting pumpkins for Halloween. And that was a huge attention getter because we're out on the diag, you know, we're outside on the lawn basically, and we've got this propane furnace cooking, and there's like, you know, glowing red hot, orange hot aluminum getting poured. And students saw that and they all came and packed around like, wow, what's going on here? Turned into a little bit of a crowd control challenge safety wise of no, stay back. Like, don't get your face up in this. But you know, that's an area where I think we as a department could do more is doing highly visible things, visually interesting things, live, active, out in public spaces. Because we do these table things, we do these recruiting events. But if I saw a column of smoke and fire coming up from a table in the Diag, I would definitely come over and see.
Maybe there's a way to bring a forge to the Diag in September and start to hammer out some blades. What do you think, Tim?
Ooh, live blacksmithing activity. Ah, I know exactly who to talk about that.
Yes, we had a whole episode of our podcast earlier about that too. So,
yep. No, that would be a great idea.
All right.
I'll make some inquiries.
And of course, I was inspired by what you did for our open houses with the casting. So I'm teaching a version of what Kevin Jones started at Florida that we did another podcast on. I'm teaching a course with an archaeologist, all focused to try to get the word out about how cool material science is to freshmen. So we teach this course called Making Things, 3 Million Years of Materials and Culture. And although it's a little different than what Kevin did, because I'm working with an archaeologist, so I give a lecture on Monday about the material science of like the clay, age of clay, or the Bronze Age, or this, you know, age of steel. And then on Wednesday, Rob Beck, the archaeologist I'm working with, he gives a lecture about the archaeology and how, you know, how culture actually did this. And then on Fridays, we have a flipped classroom where we're very intentional. We choose teams from all the different disciplines that come to this class. And there's a lot, you know, we have English majors, sociology majors, chemistry majors, physics majors, business majors, lots of engineers. We've even had kinesiology and pharmacy majors. So spread those all out on the teams. So each team has an incredibly diverse team and the students have a lot of fun. But one day when we do the module on aluminum, and you might ask like, where in the ancient world was there aluminum? Because there wasn't. But aluminum being a new material has actually ran the gamut of its acceptance and use and innovation and culture that happened in the Bronze Age. So nothing's really new. As humans, we keep doing these things the same way. And it all revolves around bottlenecks and people who control those to get wealth. So it's just fascinating.
Right.
But for that Friday activity, we bring everybody over to the Van Vlack Lab and we have them pour a Block M. And the students just love it because most of these students have never seen this before. And the opportunity to, you know, put on all the protective gear and the helmet, learn how to pick up the crucible.
Oh, yeah.
They love it. And some of them have even brought like their, you know, their some of them are married and they bring their spouse because, oh, can my spouse do this too? And
that's cool.
Just love it. So we're going to keep doing that. And so, you know, I thank you, Tim, for developing that whole activity because it really works. And we can push, you know, 40 people through in about 3 hours. And that's amazing. So that's one that we should definitely keep doing. And of course, we developed this whole course to try to attract majors, but we also try to attract majors in our Intro to Materials course. I think every program in the world does this, but we have some other specialty courses that we also try to attract people to, and you're teaching one of them this term. So why don't you talk about that, Tim?
Yeah, that's true, because the challenge with the Intro to Materials course, as you, Steve, especially know, being a long-suffering person enduring this, is that it's a lot of juniors and seniors in there who are just, you know, they're already committed to their major, and they're just knocking out their graduation requirements and trying to get their degree and get out. And you're not going to recruit a senior aerospace engineer to go change to being a materials science major. So as much as we wish that the world were different and we had lots of undeclared students in intro to MSE. The reality is we just don't. We have to get students even earlier in the life cycle. And so, as you're alluding to, freshman year is the time to do that. At Michigan, the way the engineering curriculum is set up is that there are just introduction to engineering courses that students take first before they begin going into, you know, whatever major they go into. And so they're taking intro to engineering while they're taking chemistry and physics and math and so on. Something that is really cool about the intro to engineering setup is that there are many different sections of it, and each one has its own flavor. There are shared learning objectives across them, but how those learning objectives are achieved is very different from one section to the next. There's a section where students build drones. There's a section where students develop machine learning models. There's a section where students do food science. And then there's my section, which is pitched really as a sustainable engineering course. It's like introduction to sustainable engineering, which, not very secretly, actually very transparently, is introduction to materials engineering, because if we're going to save the planet, we are going to have to develop more sustainable materials for doing engineering. We're going to have to develop more sustainable engineering processes. And a lot of that comes down to problems like material selection, like life cycle analysis, as well as materials innovation and discovery. And these are problems that are very much in the MSE space. So in teaching this freshman course, I have, out of my students, 90% or so are still undeclared. And all of those undeclared students certainly have inclinations saying, oh yeah, you know, I think I want to be a civil engineer, or, well, I'm leaning at computer science, but they are still open to, you know, exploring new ideas and seeing what's out there. And for the students who are really like, yeah, I want to save the planet, there's a really good connection here that we're making in getting those students to see that that material science is a very valuable and, you know, valid career pathway for achieving that goal. One of the students, actually, in particular, I was just talking with her last week, and at the beginning of the semester, her answer was, yeah, I'm going to go into civil engineering because I want to help build more sustainable cities. Which I'm like, yes, that's phenomenal. Sign me up. I'm on board. And then later in the semester, she's like, hey, can you tell me more about, if I got a material science minor and majored in civil engineering, would that be a good combination? And I'm like, yeah, let's talk about transit systems, right? Let's talk about roads. Let's talk about trains. Like, all of this is materials problems. And so now we're having the conversation of like, oh, I don't know, should I dual major in civil and materials? So, you know, little steps at a time, but we're getting there. And as you pointed out earlier, Steve, every student matters to us. If I get a couple declares from this course who didn't even know materials existed otherwise, absolutely, then that's a win.
And, you know, I think I may have even spoken to that, because I had just had a student in my office who was doing environmental engineering, who wants to switch to material science as a major, not as a double major, not as a minor, but as a major. So maybe that's the student I spoke to. But that all certainly happens. And even if we just put this seed of information, you know, get that seed into them, I get other majors, other people who come who started computer science and realize it's not a lot of fun. The computer science program is very competitive, and the students are competitive with each other, and it's really not a lot of fun. And, you know, you remember what Alexa Goldstein told us, the president of MMS. One of the things that she loves about our program is how non-competitive it is, how students like to help each other in classwork and getting jobs and summer internships. There is no competition in our department. And when this computer science student came, and I don't know if she took one of our Engine 100 classes, because you teach one, Max teaches one, the greatest materials inventions of all time, which is sort of an entrepreneurial version of material science. But we get a lot of students from his section who just love, you know, never heard about materials before, and now they love it. And so, you know, even if they don't come in right away, maybe a year later they remember, hey, material science looks like a really cool thing to go into. But you're right. We have to go after these students one at a time, and every one is a huge win. We only have about 40 students mm-hmm. per class. And so getting an extra 10 is, you know, a 25% increase in our class size. So, you know, if we can get 10 new students every year from all of these efforts, that's a huge win for us. And so that's what we're doing. And the last course that we have an opportunity to get students through is we teach this course, Engine 110, which is a course about what is engineering all about. It's just general elective credit, but something like, I think, over a third of all the engineering students take it in their freshman year. And so we try to get peer advisors. They hire instructional aides from all the different departments to work with the students to try to explain what each of these disciplines actually does. And I was happy to see that we have two really good students who've volunteered to do that this term. So hopefully that will help. But then, you know, again, these are old problems. We've realized as a field that this is mm-hmm. a problem for us across all programs for, you know, close to 50, 60 years now. And ASM has done a lot to try to help us with that. And you know more about this than anybody, Tim. So why don't you talk about those efforts?
Yeah, the ASM teachers camps in particular have a very special place in my heart because I was hired into the MSc department basically not knowing what material science and engineering is, typical. And that summer I attended the ASM teachers camp held at the University of Michigan, and I went, wow, I'm actually really learning a lot about this whole material science business in this teaching camp. So that was great. But what these camps are is they are a way to prepare high school teachers to teach material science and engineering in their high school courses at the high school level. And this is part of that broader societal change problem that we were discussing at the beginning, is that people, including parents, just don't know that we exist or that our field is, you know, a viable career path. So what the teachers camps do is it's professional development, like recognized, you know, accredited, certified professional development for K through 12 teachers who come in and they spend a week learning, not just MSE. They're not sitting in a classroom getting lectured at. They are doing labs, they're running experiments, learning how to build their own demos so that they can go home and actually do these things in a sustainable way, learning even the little minutiae of where do you buy this chemical from? How can you get this the cheapest so that you can do it for $10, you know, on a high school chemistry budget? And they spend the week learning all of this, and then they go back to their schools. And once they're back at their schools, usually it happens in a chemistry class, sometimes in a physics class. Very rarely a high school might have a engineering class and it can go in there. But the real win is the teachers who do that and say, wow, this is super cool. I love it. My students love it. I want to teach a material science course. And so they go to their principals and say, we need to offer this as a science elective because the students love it and I love it. And they come back to the teachers camp. And so we have what's called a year two teachers camp, which is helping these teachers learn more stuff, get more proficient with the activities, but also to design a course to teach a semester-long material science and engineering class at their high schools. And there are, I don't know the exact number, but over 100 teachers now doing this at different places around the country who have gone through these ASM teachers camps and are now teaching MSE as a high school class, which is absolutely phenomenal. And that is something that's helping, but it isn't, unfortunately, driving a lot of students to actually come major in our department. I think it's really helping with societal appreciation of MSE, but I don't think it's really getting us a lot of majors, actually. It's the same challenge with outreach. We go to high schools, we do super cool things with students. They're excited, they're happy to have us. They're like, wow, what you do is actually really neat, but I still want to go do something else professionally. And that's hard to argue with because people value the things they value. So what do we do? Like, this, I feel, is one of the biggest unanswered questions of our field, is when we're doing things with younger students, especially high schoolers, how do we get them to not just say, oh, MSE exists and it's cool, but to say MSE is a thing that I can do and that I want to do? That's the nut that we have to figure out how to crack, in my opinion.
And of course, we have at least two episodes planned about the teachers camp and about how ASM Foundation is really trying to help all materials programs with this exact problem. And I think there's a lot more we can do with ASM Foundation, and hopefully we'll help them get a broader voice out to the community so that we can make some of this happen. We've even talked about, well, we have a program, we're starting it, we don't know how it's working yet, but we've told all of our undergrads that if they would like to go back to their high schools and give a talk to, you know, pre-engineers or their chemistry class or their physics class or whatever, give a talk about their experience here as a material science and engineering major, we would pay for them to go back and talk to their high schools. So I think a few have taken us up on this, but we need to be, I don't think we're tracking it very well. So we need to, because I think that's a good idea. I mean, I still remember back when I was in high school in my biology class in ninth grade, this person came in who was a grad student in chemistry, and he told all of us about how in his lab he built a still. And that was just fascinating. We thought, like, wow, chemistry is so cool. So we'll see if that works. But in the meantime, you know, all of these things seem to work a little bit. We haven't found the magic bullet. We'd love to hear more about ideas that our community has. And so Tim and I are both on the organizing committee for the North American Materials Education Symposium, which will be in Ann Arbor on August 7th through 9th. The 7th and 8th is the symposium. The 9th are workshops that are optional. Our website is up and running. We're accepting registrations and abstract submissions. There's quite a, it's inexpensive. It's only going to cost $250 for early bird registration. That's going to last until the end of May. And we've got reasonably priced hotel blocks. It should be a great event, but we feel so strongly about this issue of how do we get more material science majors, that one of our topics is exactly this topic. And we'd love to get any of you listening to submit a talk or a poster to share your best practices. And even, you know, even if you're not doing it, ideas you might have that might be worth doing, we'd love to hear about it. So please submit talks.
That's right. Just bringing it back full circle, this is a problem that all of us have to solve together. No one person is going to have the whole solution. This is going to require everyone in the community to put our heads together and say, we need to work this out together. We need to share ideas. We need to put our different practices together and say, what can we do as a group to help all of us, not just help ourselves.
And you'll hear more about this in future podcasts. And also, if you go to our podcast website, which will be linked in the information and in the description on YouTube, if you go there, there's a place where you can hit a button and record a message for Tim and I, and you can leave a suggestion. We'd love to have an episode where we just talk about your suggestions. And if it's really good, we might even call you up and see if you're willing to be a guest on our show. So please take advantage of that.
That's right.
So I think, anything else, Tim?
Okay. No, I think we pretty much covered it. Let's get some feedback from the world here. Tell us what's good. Tell us what's bad. Give us your ideas. And really, really would love to see people at the symposium this summer so that we can share ideas.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And we'll see you later.
Excellent. Bye. See you next time.